dream. Some moaning, some groaning, some praying, some crying. Just listen, I scream. Just listen, I scream. Well, oh, oh, God. Oh, listen, I scream. Just listen, I scream. Some moaning, some groaning, some praying, some crying. Just listen, I scream. Just listen, I scream. Just listen.
Oh, yeah. It is 1 minute past 9 o'clock in the morning, and many thanks to the music makers for the gospel music. And I've been to that Mother's Day concert that Emmett puts on. It is just fabulous, everything he said and more. These are your listener-sponsored radio stations, KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno. It's time for the Saturday Morning Talkies.
Down, 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 down.
And good morning and welcome to the Saturday Morning Talkies. I'm your host, Chris Welch, and coming up, we are going to be talking with Greg Palast and Antonia Yuhas, two very heavy hitters when it comes to the role that oil plays in global economy and messes. And we're going to talk about that really big mess, growing bigger mess off the coasts of Louisiana, Florida, Mississippi, and much less all of the birds. They're, well, you'll hear. That's coming up right after these hot flashes, in which we'll start with that very leak. The Reuters is reporting that the latest attempt by BP to stop it is, they say it's unprecedented. It's this four-story tall, 98-ton steel structure that they are lowering into the sea to try to fit over the biggest of two leaks, not both of them, but just one of them. And this is a mile below the surface of the water. This has never been tried at this depth, and BP, British Petroleum officials warn that there's no certainty of success, although this is the only short-term option for containing the leak, according again to Reuters and British Petroleum, quoting British Petroleum officials. They've tried a bunch of other things. They also are drilling a relief well to try to halt the leak, but that could take up to 3 months to finish. So no short-term solutions there. They have already given up on efforts to close valves on the failed blowout preventer using underwater robots. They've been trying for 2 weeks with no luck. And after several days of calm weather, winds started to pick up today, preventing any controlled burns of the thickest concentrations of oil. According to Coast Guard, crews conducted 5 burns yesterday. Forecast said that the winds would shift and come from the south to the southwest, which could push the slick towards the Louisiana shore. Let's see. They will ask Greg Palast about these facts and figures, because he, of course, was an investigative reporter in the Exxon Valdez spill up in Alaska in the late 80s, and has written a very pithy piece on the connections, because, of course, it said Exxon on it, but in fact it was British Petroleum, according to Mr. Greg Palast. We'll talk with him later. And British Petroleum's rating on Standard & Poor has been lowered to negative. Previously it was stable, so what do they know? Of course, tons of op-ed pieces on this topic, and I'll just share bits from a couple of them right now. This is Tom Hayden writing in The Nation this week. One case against BP, Wall Street, and war. Tom Hayden says the need for greater linkages between the environmental peace and Wall Street reform movements grow by the day in the face of the epic oil spill caused by British Petroleum, a multinational firm tied to Goldman Sachs and Halliburton in oil wars from the Gulf of Mexico to the Persian Gulf. And then he mentions that the BP board chair for the past decade was once head of Goldman Sachs International, and in the 90s was director at the WTO. And he concludes by saying, Tom Hayden in The Nation, it remains for progressives to move beyond a single-issue focus to make the connections between Wall Street war and environmental destruction. And Randall Amster, writing in Truthout, he's a PhD and an attorney, and he first starts with all of the conspiracy theories that are coming up about what started this, including comments on from the right wing that this was an act of homegrown eco-terrorism by left-wing environmentalists. Rush Limbaugh pointing out the connections. And then this one, this headline, U.S. orders media blackout over North Korean torpedoing of Gulf of Mexico oil rig. And Randall Amster says, well, I'm all for a good conspiracy theory as much as the next guy or gal. But he says, the conclusion that this was a putative act of war might actually hold water. And he says, are there any two concepts in the realm of geopolitics more closely associated than resources and warfare? Oil, in particular, is the primary lubricant of the global economy, earns special status as a sine qua non of our profligate lifestyles, and simultaneously as an overt security interest that triggers our military mobilizations. He mentions Iraq and Afghanistan. And indeed, it might be said that wherever there is oil, there is war. The past decade has shown in our national security documents reflect that the U.S. will essentially do anything in its power to control as much of the world's remaining oil supplies as it possibly can, either through direct intervention or by proxy. There's nothing light or sweet about any of this. It is almost wholly crude. It appears that humanity has made a Faustian bargain that renders us the enemies of the earth in order to survive. In order to extend the life of the petroleum economy and provide the massive energy inputs that we rely upon, we have to drill deeper and deeper to procure the substance at ever-increasing energy costs. In the process, this literal sense of diminishing returns is compounded by the attendant toll exacted on our collective health via fossil fuels, as well as the concomitant stratification of wealth and power that subverts any pretense we still hold of democracy. Massive spills and other calamities are part and parcel of this normalization of a warlike attitude toward nature and thus ourselves. Randall Amster, writing in Truthout yesterday. In other news, we will be returning to that topic, as I mentioned later on in this program. Students are on hunger strike at UC Berkeley. I'm hoping to get a call from one of them sometime during this program. We'll hear Hunger for Justice. Students, activists, two university workers. They've been on hunger strike since Monday. They want UC Berkeley officials to publicly denounce the new immigration law of Arizona, as well as several other demands, including declaring UC Berkeley a sanctuary for undocumented immigrants. The demands were emailed to Chancellor Robert Bergenau on Friday, and no response as yet. Meanwhile, in England, everybody's been watching that election, and the Associated Press is reporting this morning that Britain's center-left Liberal Democrats are debating on whether to resolve, and they're the power brokers here, because they've got the Labour came in second to the Conservatives in a real turnabout, but neither party, neither of the big parties, has enough seats to control Parliament, so they both need the center-left Liberal Democrats, which is the good news. But they are debating on whether to join the Conservative Party in an unlikely right-wing center-left coalition. They share common ground on economic policy, according to the Associated Press. They would commit to a tough program of spending cuts aimed at reducing the deficit. The pace of austerity measures would be slower in a coalition than if the Conservatives had won an outright majority. The Conservatives are 20 votes short, and the 57 members of Liberal Democrats could pull them into the majority, of course. They want, the Liberals, on the other hand, the Liberal Democrats want a reformed voting system that could allocate seats in Parliament based on vote share. That would mean that in this election they would have gotten 23% of the national vote, but they only got 9% of the seats in the House of Commons. They want that to change. The Conservatives are not interested in that, but maybe they'll make a deal. That's what they're going to be meeting on Sunday, to try to make this deal. And so stay tuned for that. Lots of news out of Europe and Greece and their economic situation, and the deal that was cut for austerity measures there to get loans from the IMF, etc. Reuters is reporting that more than half of Greeks polled support the austerity for aid deal with the EU and the IMF and are willing to make more sacrifices to exit this crisis. 54.2% in this poll. And meanwhile, European Union officials are working out the details of a financial support mechanism to prevent the debt turmoil in Greece from spreading, namely to Portugal and Spain. And EU finance ministers will be meeting on Sunday to agree to it or disagree to it. And everybody's going to be there. Silvio Berlusconi and Nicolas Sarkozy both canceled trips to Moscow to mark the anniversary of the end of World War II in order to be there. Although Angela Merkel says she's going to be at the World War II ceremony, thank you. In other news, the United States is welcoming, according to Reuters, the Palestine Liberation Organization's decision today to approve indirect talks with Israel as an important step in the peace process. So George Mitchell is going to follow up with Abbas, and et cetera, et cetera. So that means that George will be the PLO Executive Committee meeting in Ramallah, and the occupied West Bank approved the so-called proximity talks, whose launch may be announced later today. On that same neck of the woods, there is news coming out thanks to the Corey family's lawsuit against the State of Israel. Information slowly coming out, evidence emerging, which appears to implicate Israel's Gaza commander at the time Rachel Corrie was killed by an Israeli army bulldozer in Gaza, and an attempt to obstruct the official investigation into her death. Major General Doron Almog was then head of Israel's Southern Command. He denies ordering a bulldozer commander to desist from testifying, which is what the evidence is showing here. So that's still unfolding as well. And speaking of unfolding, the ash cloud from the Icelandic volcano is moving south, and there all kinds of flights are being canceled again all over Europe. If you're on your way there or knowing somebody trying to come home, that might be a problem. And on the Times Square investigation, they say that U.S. counterterrorism officials are saying that the Times Square plot is a possible signal that militant leaders in Pakistan have shifted focus to targets in the U.S. and the West instead of sticking to their home base. And on the topic of the Taliban in Afghanistan, the Associated Press is reporting that they are announcing that they are going to launch a fresh offensive across Afghanistan this coming week. They say that starting Monday, they're going to be assassinating government officials. They're going to be planting roadside bombs, and they're going to be directing suicide attacks against foreigners and those who support them. The defense minister of Afghanistan quickly dismissed this threat as insurgent propaganda, saying the Taliban do not have the ability to launch a series of attacks across Afghanistan. Of course, that's what they said about Times Square. And in, I have to tell you this one, in Lithuania, there was a gay pride parade today. They say about 400 people took part in the two-hour march dubbed For Equality in a sealed-off area in downtown Vilnius, Lithuania. Large rainbow flags, dancing, walking on a road near the river. Participants included many foreigners, diplomats, and members of the European Parliament. However, there were also opponents throwing smoke bombs. They tried to break through a barrier to disturb the parade, where they were stopped by police firing tear gas. Protesters threw rocks and street signs at security forces. Two Lithuanian lawmakers were detained after trying to climb the barrier. The parade was originally allowed by the Vilnius City Council. It was prohibited on Wednesday by a court on security concerns, but on Friday, yesterday, an appeals court overturned the ban, and they marched today. And that's that for the good news. Of course, more real news coming your way at 6 o'clock this evening on KPFA. And coming up on this program today, as I mentioned, we're going to be speaking with Greg Palast and Antonia Juhas in a few moments about what's happening with the oil slick and what is happening with British Petroleum, not only off the shores of Louisiana with this particular episode, but with the rest of us as well, and our not only increased reliance, but our entanglement governmentally and economically with these giants of oil. Don't go away. Maybe it's because I played clarinet in high school. This is the clarinet thing. All those folks, Beth Custer, organizing Sheldon Brown, Harvey Weinappel, and Ben Goldberg. This is their CD, Cry Want. And this particular tune is In the Mornings Out There. Carla Bley, the composer. And before we turn to Greg Palast and Antonia Juhas, we have on the telephone with us Madeline Kovacs, who has been working with the youth climate movement for the past 4 years. And she is now the co-coordinator of Project Survival Media, which is a global network of youth journalists reporting from the front lines of the climate crisis. I met one of their members when I was moderating a panel with the women from all over the planet who are at the cutting edge, namely their islands are going underwater, of the global warming climate crisis. And I'm very happy that they've kept in touch, because I'm anxious to know what else they're up to. So welcome, Madeline. I'm very glad you could join us.
Hi, thanks very much.
So tell me about Project Survival Media and what you all are up to, and give us some examples.
Sure. So I co-coordinate Project Survival Media with Shadi Fain Wood, who appeared on the women's panel, which was fabulous. It was wonderful to see. Basically, the point of the program is to involve a network of youth journalists all over the world in reporting on climate change from a human perspective. So what's happening right now? You know, what are the things that are changing people's lives as we speak? How do we get those voices, you know, into the mainstream media? And then how do we go about addressing the problem in these different places? So basically, Project Survival Media looks at how people are coping with climate change and how their survival is already being impacted. I mean, it's not, you know, a problem that we might be dealing with in 50 years. You know, it's here now in many places all over the world, including the United States, as we've seen recently in the Gulf of Mexico, with, you know, increased hurricanes, Hurricane Katrina, et cetera, et cetera. And so basically, but what we try to do is focus on not only the really severe impacts, you know, and from a point of view of survival, then this year we'll be focusing on solutions for survival, which is our new program that we'll be launching this year for 2010-2011. And what that tries to do is take the issue, but then focus on people who are becoming real innovators all over the world. So there are a lot of young people, especially in under-resourced areas, who might be very talented, who might have a video camera, but when they go out and they talk to people and they record what's going on, maybe they don't have somewhere to put it, you know, or maybe they don't have a network to tap into where we can share that media with people globally. And that's what the youth climate movement globally really does. I mean, we were at COP15. In Copenhagen, the UN climate negotiations there. We worked with a team of 18 youth journalists, and it was really wonderful to be able to link these young people with, you know, the opportunity to interview their peers and talk with other young people and really network in a way that is building a global movement that has a deeper understanding of where we're all coming from and move forward with one voice, because it's our future.
Okay. I'm just going to ask you, why youth? Why does it have to be youth? Why was there the need for this global network of youth journalists?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are kind of two reasons for that. First of all, as young people, the blogs that young people write and the media that they make tend to be much more focused on, okay, we have this political problem, you know, we're lacking the political will to really find solutions, and I'm disappointed by that. But stopping there isn't an option for me. You know, I'm going to live out the rest of my life on a planet that's going to be changing. Like, the fundamentals of the systems of life are going to be altering. And so I think young people approach it across the board, and this is, I've talked to young people from so many different countries at the last UN climate negotiations, and what we all had in common was, okay, we recognize this, we recognize the political failures, we recognize the systemic failures, I'm ready to move beyond that. I'm ready to really focus on solutions, I'm ready to get to work. And so that is a mentality that I think is so necessary in the political dialogue today, globally and in the U.S., you know, because at some point, part of it is also education, you know, and the other part is education. People don't fully understand, in a lot of places, especially in the United States, to be perfectly honest, about the impacts that our actions have all over the globe, or just the idea that people are already suffering, that climate change is real, and that it's not, you know, something little here or there. It's literally drinking water for someone's family. But when you give people that message, you know, you don't want to just bombard them with something really negative and have them shut down or retreat into a corner. You want to say, no, we're engaged, you know, we're all finding solutions together, and let's share those. You know, let's broadcast those solutions, let's highlight those leaders. And, you know, one idea in the Gambia can become something that might be applicable to a small town in the U.S. You never know. there are so many young people out there doing incredible things.
Right on. Well, and we that's what the stories that need to get out, and I hope that is what Project Survival Media is getting out, the stories of what the young people themselves are doing.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. So you've got an event or a something. There's something, a project that you're working on right now. Is there not? Am I correct about that?
Exactly. Well, we are launching a two-part project. A two-part media project that basically addresses those two issues as I kind of laid them out. One's a U.S. documentary focused on re-examining U.S. energy potential region by region. So looking at stories of real people, finding real solutions, and also coupling that with some really hefty research on what would happen if we were serious about renewable energy in these regions. You know, what do these regions have to offer in terms of solar or wind or, you know, energy efficiency? But then also taking a good hard look at the money that we spend investing in dirty energy. We're going to be addressing a quote by President Obama in his last State of the Union that, you know, we need to invest in more sources of dirty energy because we just can't meet our demand. And we're going to challenge that and say, well, really, you know, can we look a little deeper? And then the second part is the Climate Solutions Exchange, which is a website where we'll basically be doing just what I talked about, which is going out and we'll be doing a very rigorous application process and putting together 15 new media teams globally. And these teams will be focusing on solutions areas like, you know, water issues and solar, and looking at women as a solution to climate change, looking at agriculture, looking at, you know, energy efficiency, urban design. I mean, a lot of these different things. There are so many angles from which to approach solutions. So we're going to be launching that program on Wednesday, May 19th at 7:30 at the Women's Building in San Francisco, 18th and Guerrero, and we'll have free food and wine. We're gonna have an art auction with some of our pieces that we're going to print, some great photographs from around the world, and also a local artist. We will also be having some live performers, and Shadi and I will be doing a great presentation and doing some video screenings from our work last year. And we really hope that people can make it and come out and support us, but also learn quite a bit and network with some really awesome young people.
And also get totally energized by the energy and by the solution focus. I love that it's solution, because it's so easy to just be tearing your hair out when all you do is look at the news or it's just terrible what's happening everywhere.
Yeah.
And you get the sense of doom that there's nothing to be done.
Yep.
And I'm really, really, I love that you guys are focusing on what people are already doing. Yay!
Totally. We have two options. You know, we can whine about it and worry about it a little bit more, or we can, you know, roll up our sleeves now and try to be a little bit ahead of the curve and just do our best. And that's what we're all about.
Amen. So how do people get more information? In addition to showing up on the 19th, which is a Wednesday evening, about 2 weeks from now, or is that right? Two weeks. Wednesday, the 19th of May, 7:30 at the Women's Building in San Francisco. What's the website, all that kind of stuff?
Our website is www.projectsurvivalmedia.org, one word, and we have all of our great mini documentaries from last year and information about the party up there as well.
Yeehaw. Madeline Kovacs, our guest on the phone, the co-coordinator of ProjectSurvivalMedia.org. She interned with the United Auto Workers Local 879.
Mm-hmm.
And she also was on a Amazon Resource Management and Human Ecology Program semester in Brazil. And she she got the Dean of Students Community Recognition Award. This will not surprise anyone from listening to her, for activism and passion on climate change. Congratulations, and I'm so glad that you're doing this work. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay. Once again, Wednesday, the 19th, 7:30 at the Women's Building. Next up, Greg Palast and Antonia Yuhas. Don't go away. from Beth Custer and the clarinet thing. And would that we could stay there, but let's go here for a moment. This is our president earlier this week.
We are working closely with the Gulf states and local communities to help every American affected by this crisis. So let me be clear. BP is responsible for this leak. BP will be paying the bill. But as President of the United States, I'm going to spare no effort to respond to this crisis for as long as it continues. And we will spare no resource to clean up whatever damages cost. And while there will be time to fully investigate what happened on that rig and hold responsible parties accountable, our focus now is on a fully coordinated, relentless response effort to stop the leak and prevent more damage to the Gulf.
President Barack Obama speaking, not flying over, but speaking. But we'll find out what he means and what good it might do, what he intends. Meanwhile, the leading edge of the vast oil slick is starting to come ashore in Louisiana, a shroud of devastation, according to Dan Frumkin, writing in the Huffington Post yesterday. Most of the damage remains invisible deep below the surface, including wide-scale destruction of essential plankton in the sea, wiping out an entire generation of fish larvae. One gentleman said, all that carbon we're seeing poison the Gulf was headed into the planetary ecosystem anyway through tailpipe emissions. It just took a shortcut. Hopefully this will break open the debate on both the climate and energy bills in Washington, among other things. Of course, this is the April 20th explosion of the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig atop British Petroleum's Macondo oil well, more than 18,000 feet below sea level in the Gulf of Mexico. And everyone's been complaining about British Petroleum, even Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana. He's very disturbed. He says it becomes clear that they have no detailed plan to address an incident on this scale. They're deploying booms. I reported in the newscast this morning that they're putting this 98-ton, they're trying to get this 98-ton, four-story tall steel cap on one of the leaks. Even as we speak, they are saying there's no certainty of success. Well, that's at least a slightly different tack than BP has been taking. They didn't even file a plan to specifically handle a major oil spill because the federal agency that regulates offshore rigs changed its rules 2 years ago to exempt them. The Minerals Management Service, an arm of the Interior Department, well known for its cozy relationship with major oil companies. In fact, they even, disciplinary action was taken against this MMS, the Minerals Management Service, for accepting lavish gifts, partying, in some cases having sex with employees from the companies that they regulate. And in addition to being, this is their discipline, they were given upgraded ethics training. Meanwhile, British Petroleum is no joke, and they announced more than $6 billion in profits for the first quarter of 2010, just a week ago, more than doubling profits for the same period the year before. Who needs no stinking spill? Revenues of $327 billion are enough to rank BP as the third largest corporation in the country. And the history of British Petroleum in Iran, you will recall, was what brought us where we are today to Iran, basically. It was the overthrow of the popularly elected Mossadegh because he had demanded that the then-named Anglo-Iranian oil company, which became BP, share more of their profits from Iranian oil with Iranian people. And they refused, so they nationalized the oil industry in Iran. Mossadegh did, and the CIA came in and said, that's all for you, buddy. Next Wednesday, there is a national day of action at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. There, the Answer Coalition, among other folks, including, I believe, is going to be at New York on New York Avenue at 11th Street in New York City, I believe. But this is What's interesting about this as well is that the history of the American oil spills is the history of the environmental movement. This is an op-ed contributor in the New York Times writing from Oakland, California. She reminds us that the 1969 blowout of an oil platform off Santa Barbara, California gave rise to Earth Day and led to the first moratorium of new drilling off Atlantic and Pacific coasts. She's hoping that the likely political outcome will be a moratorium on offshore drilling, but she points out moratoriums have a moral problem. All oil comes from someone's backyard, and when we don't reduce the amount of oil we consume and refuse to drill at home, we end up getting people to drill for us in Kazakhstan, Angola, Nigeria. Nigeria has suffered spills equivalent to that of the Exxon Valdez every year since 1969. As of last year, Nigeria had 2,000 active spills. And since the Santa Barbara spill of 1969 and the more than 40 Earth Days that have followed, Americans have increased by two-thirds the amount of petroleum we consume in our cars, while nearly quadrupling the quantity we import. Effectively, we have been importing oil and exporting spills to villages and waterways all over the world. Joining us on the telephone right now, Greg Palast, investigative journalist and author of Best Democracy Money Can Buy, Armed Madhouse, etc. And he was there in Alaska with the Exxon Valdez investigating. Good morning to you, Greg.
Glad to hear from you. Yes, I was up in Alaska as not as a journalist, as people know me, but as an investigator for the natives that own the shoreline that was slimed, investigating fraud and racketeering by the oil companies.
And in fact, you found, although it says Exxon Valdez, that British Petroleum was there too.
Yeah, in fact, my conclusion was that fraud and racketeering were committed. I used to do these investigations, and the main perpetrator, the main party responsible for the destruction in Alaska was not Exxon, despite their name on the boat, and believe me, not letting them off the hook. It was British Petroleum. The difference is that while Exxon had its name on the boat, the organization in charge of containing the spill, stopping it from hitting the shoreline, is a group called Alyeska, of which BP is the majority owner, is the controlling owner. It's British Petroleum, just like they are the controlling owner of the well in the Gulf, but they put their name on it, so no one has any doubt. I mean, by the way, its partners, for example, are Mitsubishi of Japan in the Gulf well. So it was BP that slimed Alaska, and they did it in the same way that they're sliming the entire Gulf Coast, which is failure to contain. I think people may miss the idea, which is that you know, BP said, of course, the well would never blow out and you'd never have a tanker grounding and all that stuff. But the truth is,
and that's why we don't need no stinking regulations.
Right, exactly. But they do happen, and it is their job to make sure that there's a spill containment plan in place, is number one, and two, to carry it out. And what I found in Alaska is that they had, not the best, but they had a spill plan in case there was an accident like the Exxon Valdez, but they lied. And in fact, you shouldn't have even read about the Exxon Valdez. It should have been just a blip in the newspaper for a day, and that would have been it. Tanker, its reef, goodbye. What happened was that British Petroleum, in their plan, said in writing, we will have oil containment boom. In other words, by the way, just so you know, the way to stop oil from hitting beach is real simple. When it starts pouring out of a well or a tanker or whatever, or a pipe, you surround it with rubber. This is not rocket science, oil spill containment. It just isn't. It's not rocket science. You put a bunch of rubber around it, and you take a skimmers, and you suck the stuff out. And that's what you do. And if they, and in the case of the Exxon, which hit Bligh Reef, there were supposed to be giant, you know, miles of rubber skirt to hold that oil sitting right there on Bligh Island ready. That was one. The second thing, they were supposed to have full-time emergency crews, just like you have a fire department. Don't have a city without a fire department. You cannot have oil drilling without a full-time oil spill response crew. And in Alaska, British Petroleum said we would have that they had a full-time spill response crew that they had contracted with the native villages and equipped the natives. They even had helicopters. These guys are supposed to drop out of the airplanes and drop the dispersants, drop the rubber skirts. Well, they had fired the natives and never informed the federal or state government that they'd gotten rid of the full-time response crews. The natives were literally standing on the beach watching the ship run aground. They were standing out there. It was midnight, and they watched the ship run aground. They had had the job of stopping the oil. All they had to do, if the rubber skirts were there, if they had still had the equipment and been hired, they'd have been out there in minutes. And within 1 hour, the Exxon Valdez would have been surrounded, and then the stuff would have been sucked out by a skimmer. And by the way, the skimmer was on a containment barge, which is like a fire engine.
So basically you're saying that they nickeled and dimed it to spill, basically. That they just kept paying those guys and having the stuff there, they could have taken care of it.
No problem.
Oh.
Exactly. But it costs millions to maintain these things.
Uh-huh.
They're supposed to also have a containment ship ready and not operate without it in place. And sure enough, the containment ship, even though they said they'd never run a ship without the emergency barge in place, the emergency barge is in a dry dock under ice. It's Alaska. And they just had left it there, not ready for anything. So there was no way to contain that spill. Same with, and they did it again. And Tony Hayward, who is the CEO of British Petroleum, boasted this past year they had cut their expenses by billions, That's why they've made billions this year. They're profitable.
Yeah, exactly.
And he was proud to announce that they cut a billion more than they had planned to cut, so that they had actually, British Petroleum has dropped its production costs, even though its production is rising, and even though the production is rising in dangerous areas like deep water. How do you save an extra $1 billion a year? The answer is no emergency crews. The answer is no rubber boom. The answer is no skimmers. And I have to tell you, in the Gulf, it was the Navy, after Obama called it a national emergency on Thursday. I don't know what he was doing from Saturday to Wednesday. I don't know, fundraising or playing golf or with the bankers. But when he finally called it an emergency, the Navy moved in with 12 miles of boom, rubber boom. They moved in with 7 skimmers. If they had done that, if British Petroleum had that type of equipment, which they should have had, and moved it in place, this thing would have been contained in 24 hours.
Greg Palast talking to us from his home in New York, the author of several books, Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Armed Madhouse. On the other line with us here in the Bay Area, Antonia Yuhas, who directs the Chevron program at Global Exchange. Her book is entitled The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. And I don't know, talk about that part, about this news that they've had this huge profit, must say something about, and the cozy relationship with the regulating agency is, I would imagine, the tip of the iceberg as far as how we are in thrall to this corporation.
Sure. Good morning, Chris, and good morning, Greg. What I have written the most about in regard to the incident is the lobbying capacity and the campaign capacity of BP and, of course, the entire oil industry. 2009 was the first year in history that 7 of the 10 largest corporations in the world were oil companies, and that's based on revenue. If you look at what I think is actually even a more important figure, which is profit, then the reason why I think it's more important is because that's their cash on hand. That's what they use to do things like lobby and enter into political campaigns. And that the profits of this industry, they're just absolutely is literally no comparison, no historical comparison and no current industrial comparison. Banks, for a time, challenged the wealth of the oil industry, but basically, beginning with the start of the Bush administration, the profits of the oil industry just catapulted, and of course, $150 barrel oil pushed them into an unknown stratosphere of wealth. And last year, those profits did fall. That's the reason why BP's profits were so much greater this quarter than they were last quarter.
Uh-huh.
The price of oil, of course, went from $150 down to $35 a barrel, and that significantly increased the profits of the oil industry for 2009. But the price of a barrel of oil is back to $86 a barrel. They're doing just fine. Nothing to worry about for the poor oil industry. So what they're doing with that money is lobbying. And BP, like the entire oil industry, basically as soon as Bush went out and Obama came in and the Democrats came into the Congress, They stop being inside the government as they were deeply rooted in the Bush administration, and they had to start lobbying from outside of the government, and they dramatically increased the amount of money they spent on lobbying. BP massively broke its records in both 2008 and 2009 on its lobbying expenditures, and significantly increased its campaign expenditures as well. And that has led to continued a process of a relationship with regulators and policymakers that is obscene. And you referenced the scandals with the Mineral Management Services. I wrote a section in my book called Sex, Lies, and Paintball, which is about that time. And literally they were having sex, doing drugs, playing paintball with the companies they were supposed to be regulating. And that was just a perfect embodiment of the relationship that had developed, particularly during the Bush years, between the regulators and the regulatees. And what happened with BP is not at all atypical. The exemption that it was given from a thorough environmental assessment for its production in the Gulf, the Mineral Management Service takes in about 400 leases every single year for offshore operations, and they basically rubber stamp them. And that is horribly dangerous. I think it's hard for some of us to grasp the extent of what this type of offshore operations are. In fact, most drilling in the Gulf, most platforms in the Gulf of Mexico are at 30 feet, 120 feet, but most drilling now has, in the last 10 years, started to take place at these ultra, ultra deep depths. So a deep well is 1,000 feet below the water surface. An ultra deep well is 5,000 feet. BP was drilling 18,000 feet below the Earth's surface. And when that technology that is new, which it is to do that, also does not come with it at all any concept of what the appropriate technology would be for cleaning up an accident. The U.S. government didn't require BP to utilize the best technology and the best safeguards, and that was a regulatory oversight, and BP's choice also not to put in place those. Oversight is a weak word. That is a huge failure on the part of the U.S. government, and a huge slap that BP also gave by choosing not to put in place that technology itself. But there also is no technology known that has ever dealt with a spill at this depth. We just have never done it before. The cap that they're putting in place right now has been used,
trying to put in place,
has successfully been used. I think the greatest depth that's ever been used is 400 feet.
Yeah.
So this is a problem industry-wide. It's not just BP. BP is unfortunately well-known in the country for the last great big workplace incident in the history of the United States in the last 15 years was a BP refinery in Texas City that exploded. It's not, unfortunately, surprising that the big accident next that happened in the oil industry was BP, but this certainly is not a BP problem. This is an oil industry problem that we have allowed the industry, and Chevron has really been the leader in lobbying to open up more areas of the coast to offshore drilling. We've allowed them to go places they shouldn't go. We've allowed them to go to those places without regulatory oversight. And this is a dangerous business, no matter where it's being done, no matter what's happening, whether it's a gas pipeline, a refinery, a gas station, oil production, transportation, and a tanker. This is a dangerous business, and it must be regulated until it's restricted altogether.
Antonia Yuhas directs the Chevron program at Global Exchange, and her book is entitled The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry, and What We Must Do to Stop It. You can go to www.tyrannyofoil.org for more information. Greg Palast, also on the line, investigative journalist and author, and you can go to www.gregpalast.com for all his information, and he blogs and writes all over the place, too. What I'm interested in the little time we have left here on Mother's Day weekend and the Earth, Mother, our Mother Earth. Lisa Marganelli, I quoted from her piece in the New York Times, A Spill of Our Own. She says, the Deepwater Horizon spill illustrates that every gallon of gas is a gallon of risks. Risks of spills in production and transport, of worker deaths, of asthma-inducing air pollution, of climate change, to name a few. We should print these risks on every gasoline receipt, just as we label smoking's risk on cigarette packs. And we should throw our newfound political will behind a sweeping commitment to use less gas, build cars that use less or none at all, and figure out better ways to transport Americans. So this newfound political will, do you think it can beat, Greg, the lobbying power that Antonio just described briefly?
Yeah.
Well, good.
I'll say something cynically, you know, I'm a cynical cat.
But you're a father, too.
But the truth is that there is an Earth Day. I mean, Richard Nixon was forced to sign off on the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency. The politicians follow. We don't have leaders, you know. I mean, we've got the Pope of Hope, but, you know, we're not going to get much from that. We forced them. And if we don't keep up the pressure on these guys, deep well offshore drilling is per se dangerous. It's completely mad and nuts because, as we just found out, they get the profits, we take the risk, we get the cost, and the idea that we are going to recover the cost. Obama made a big statement. Yeah, like he's getting the money back from the banks.
Right.
The law says, Mr. Obama, who is a constitutional lawyer, the law says that their liability is limited to $75 million. We already blew that baby. And by the way, I wouldn't be surprised if BP turns around and says, well, where was the U.S. government? They play a wonderful game. They say, please don't regulate us. And then when the spit hits the fan, they say, where was the government?
Well, and did anybody in Alaska get any money from Exxon Valdez?
Oh, my God. I mean, I worked on the litigation. The natives and fishermen just this year got their checks 21 years after the spill. 21 years. And the punitive damages against Exxon were cut by 90% from $5 billion to $500 million. By the Supremes. And here's the kicker on that. British Petroleum, which, as I said, was the most responsible for the sliming of Alaska, which caused at least $4 or $5 billion in damage. Damage that's there today. British Petroleum paid $125 million. That's all they paid. And that was completely 100% covered by their oil company insurance fund. They got away with it, and that's why they did it again, because over the last 20 years, they saw what happened in Alaska. Over the past 20 years, they have saved literally billions. If their savings is merely $2 billion a year, they've already saved $40 billion by skimping. So if they cut some deal where they have to pay $3, $4, $5 billion, they're still way ahead on the game. Way ahead. It's a profit. Law, it's a profit center. Plus, don't forget, they're claiming they're spending $4 to $6 million a day. BP sells 8 million barrels a day, and the price of oil shot up immediately by $2.50 a barrel because of the spill. Immediately. So they're actually making a profit day to day on the spill at this moment.
Antonio, what do you think of the chances of a real energy bill, much less a real climate bill, if that's our only hope? Maybe there is other hopes as well.
Yeah, I think certainly not this bill. The bills that are currently being proposed are bad bills, but I think we definitely have the chance for real change. And I think it's exactly as Lisa Marganelli said. The work that we're doing at Global Exchange with just an amazing international coalition is building a network of communities harmed by and fighting back against one company, Chevron, so that we can show, just looking at one company, wherever you're looking, whether it's Richmond, Los Angeles, Mississippi, Chevron's coal mines, which it operates in New Mexico and Alabama, where Chevron's operations in Angola, Chad, Ecuador, Thailand, Indonesia, whether it's gas or oil or refineries, et cetera, there is harm caused, real human health, long-term climactic economic harm, and, but more significantly, more importantly, There are amazing communities resisting, fighting back, having victories. And if we can not only hear about the harm, but also the success, that we actually can and do rein in and regulate this industry all the time, but it's small victories because we tend to be small, isolated communities. And if we can hear more about these victories, unite them, and build more advocates demanding long-term change that is not just about small fixes, but for as long as we continue to use oil, which we will for at least a little while, we have to regulate this industry, rein it in, restrict it. And at the same time, we have to demand policies, because individuals can do a lot, but when policy is implemented that turns our individual action into collective actions, it's even more powerful. So,
Antonia Yuhas at Global Exchange, her book, The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It, www.tyrannyofoil.org, Greg Palast at gregpalast.com. Thank you both so very much for joining us today, and Antonia for giving me the idea of what we have to do on a future show. And that's just about all she wrote. I did want to share just a little bit this here. This is Izzy. Well, we just tell you a little bit about things going on today at the David Brower Center in Berkeley at 8 p.m. There is a wonderful program on Ohlone Presence, an evening of storytelling, theater, and song from Ohlone land and history. It'll be fabulous. Nina Wise has her new performance piece, What Just Happened. It's totally whatever comes to her in the moment, and I really would love to hear what she's going to be doing about all of this stuff in the news, because that's part of what she does. It's at the Marsh and the East Bay, Berkeley, 2120 Alston Way in Berkeley, and it's Fridays and Saturdays, Fridays at 9 o'clock, and tonight Saturdays at 8 o'clock. Except tonight, it's going to be at 9 o'clock. She's just trying to fake us out. Okay, 9 o'clock tonight at the Marsh in Berkeley, 2120 Alston Way, Nina Wise. Mother's Day, Barbara Dane is going to be performing tomorrow night at 8 p.m. at the Freight and Salvage on Addison in Berkeley. And just to share with you, my birthday was on Monday, and I got many cards, but two I want to share with you. This one, Mom, these sandwiches are super. Yeah, what's in them? Why, liverwurst and Valium, dear. You deserve a break today. Thanks from Jaw and Wavy. And this one from my sister. Happiness is like peeing in your pants. Everyone can see it, but only you can feel its warmth. So may you have a very happy weekend. Feel the warmth. Give yourself a break. And have a good one.
Okay, it's 94.1 KPFA.